Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are. My name is Preeta, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awakening Call. The purpose of these calls is to really share stories and to tell stories and to hear stories. Stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us and through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. Today, our very special guest speaker is none other than Kay Prannis, who is someone who is has been holding space herself for so many people for so many decades. She embodies our theme of holding safe spaces and supporting the emergence of collective wisdom through circle practices and by learning to not know. Here's how the call is going to work. In a few minutes, our amazing moderator, Molly Rowan, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Kay Prannis. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. So, as I mentioned, this week's theme is really about circle practice. It's something that the service-based community and the awakened community has been doing for many years as a way of holding safe space for people, and to let kind of a group and emergent collective wisdom come out and also individual wisdom to deepen. Kay Prannis is, you know, really one of the original people who has really made circle practice a prominent feature of the justice system in the U.S. or a piece of the justice system in the U.S. She learned it from the indigenous people. And I think there's really no one better to talk to us about this than Kay. I actually had the pleasure earlier this year of sitting in on a circle training session that Kay led in Boston, and I was just really, really moved by her capacity to really hold space and deeply listen to others and let the group work through the discomfort of its own processes, and not to try and insert herself, but really to let the group go through what it needed to go through. And I was really struck by her self-restraint and, as I said, her sense of compassion and just her deep art by which she engaged in circle practice. So I'm really excited to hear from her. And before really to lead the conversation with her, we have an incredible person to do that, Molly Rowan, who herself has been very involved in restorative justice. She is the founder of Restorative Justice on the Rise, which she started as a response to her own witnessing up close and in person the devastating effects of the punitive justice system. She's spoken about how her own mother was incarcerated with mental illness for close to 15 years in the state of Idaho. She brings her passion to this incredible work on every level, and she's also inspired, as Kay is, by the global traditions and movements of people on the periphery of societies. And the practices of indigenous people in particular, who've shown the way over time to help us gain clarity by restorative justice practices, including circle practices. So with that, I'm going to hand this off to Molly to more fully introduce Kay and to kick off the conversation.
Thank you so much, Preeta, and a very blessed morning to everyone, wherever you're calling in from. It's wonderful to be with you here, and I would just like to set the intention right away that this is a circle itself, even though a virtual one of sorts, that we're here together connecting on as deep a level as possible today together, and it's an honor to be with each and every one of you. And that was a beautiful introduction, Preeta, of Kay, and words are kind of hard to suffice for Kay's presence, but without further ado, it's really such an honor to be with you here today, Kay, on this Awaken call. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And so I'm just going to dive right in with a question for you, Kay, about the seven core assumptions as we go in and start unpacking what a circle process values and what the energy field of a circle process might be journeying towards, even though it's not a destination, what are those seven core assumptions and how do they set a deep foundation for a circle process?
So the seven core assumptions were a set of beliefs that Carolyn and I, when we were writing Heart of Hope, decided that we should let readers know where we were coming from and what we saw as sort of fundamental beliefs of our practice and this way of using circle. So we tried to just get really clear about, you know, what is all of this grounded in as we understand it. And so the first assumption is that the true self in everyone is good, wise, and powerful. And circle for me is very, very rooted in this idea that every one of us is born with a fundamental inclination to be in good relationship with others. And that's genetic because we evolved in community, and so our genes have to carry the information for how to be successful in community. So that we're born with a powerful impulse to be in good relationship with others, and that we're also born with the knowledge about what it takes to be in good relationship with others. And we talk about that as the true self, the core self, or the best self, and that in everyone, that is good, wise, and powerful. That's not to deny that we're capable of other kinds of things, but that we always do still have that in us. And this assumption is that no matter what happens to you or what you do, that's still there, though it might be deeply buried. Second assumption, that the world is profoundly interconnected. This is one of the most important things that I came to understand more clearly working with indigenous people, is that this understanding of everything as so interconnected that you cannot disconnect. You know, it's not possible in the nature of the universe. And once we understand that, it has huge implications for everything that we do, because then we understand that everything we put out also comes back to us through all of this connection. The third one is this idea that all human beings have a deep desire to be in a good relationship, that's a part of human nature. The fourth is that all humans have gifts. Everyone is needed for what they bring. And that means that it's not about some of us are more important than others, that we're all needed, and not just humans, but every other aspect of the universe brings its gift, that it's everything has a purpose and a role. The fifth is that everything we need to make positive change is already here. We have it. We have the wisdom ourselves. We have the knowledge. If we can find ways to access that and together. The sixth, that human beings are holistic, that you cannot work just with the mind or just with the body, that human beings have these other aspects, the emotional side, the spiritual side, they're always there. And when we're not paying attention to those, then they often impact us sideways, and we don't really understand what's going on, that we have to work with the whole human being. And then the seventh is this idea that in order to live from this core self that represents the best in us, that we have to practice. That practices are really important, and that circle is a practice. And that if you don't practice it, it's harder than to use it when you need it. And that all of these things build on each other and can become habits of how you show up in the world, but only if you practice. So those are the seven core assumptions that we thought. It was interesting because when we wrote the first book, Heart of Hope, we were just trying to frame what was in it. And then we discovered that lots of people took those seven core assumptions. I know someone who has created laminated sheets and puts them in the center of every circle. And then someone else told me that they created a training exercise where they put people into seven small groups, and each one is assigned one of the seven core assumptions. And each group then does a little circle to deepen their thinking about that particular assumption, and then they come back and present to the rest of the whole group. So it's been interesting to watch how something we put out there, other people grew it and did things with it that we had not even imagined.
Okay, in your extraordinary journey, one of the people that you have worked with, I think fairly closely, is Howard Zaire. And I believe one of his books that he has written is called Changing Lenses. And I wondered if you might share with us what it means to see life from a lens, in particular to the values that you've just described. How do we walk as in our lives individually as well as in systems from the lens of a circle?
Yeah, basically your lens is your paradigm, right? Your mental model for what's true about the nature of the universe. And for me, all of this work represents a very, very deep shift in paradigm, in worldview, in the assumptions we are making about the nature of the universe and therefore our own nature as well. And so for me, it colors and shapes everything. And having gotten into this work and having the opportunity to practice very frequently, being in circle and thinking about interconnection, it just keeps evolving for me in terms of my own depth of understanding, or depth of understanding. I don't know if that's the right phrase, but my own sense of what this means to me. I think it's about how we build our social institutions, how we operate those social institutions. I think that the implications of this work are for profound change in all of the structural relationships that we have in our social institutions, because if you take those seven core assumptions, those are not the core assumptions of our social institutions. We've got, and that includes families and faith communities and social services and schools and the justice system. Basically, all of our institutions, in general, there are always exceptions to that, but our institutions in general are built on a very different set of assumptions. And so that's the lens. Those assumptions describe the lens through which you are making decisions every day about what you do and don't do, and how you see others, how you relate to others, the judgments that you make about yourself and about others. I think it's why this work has turned out to be even more challenging than people thought at the beginning, is that the shift it represents is much deeper than many of us originally.
Kay, can you share maybe one or two vignettes of what you might have seen in your own processes with people across the country and wherever your work takes you, but specific to people here, I guess, in the Western world, so to speak, and how they might be having epiphanies of shifting from this paradigm of isolation and retribution to one of interconnection and resolution. And do you have any snapshots you'd like to share of experiences in that way?
For instance, the way that I think this can really help us, some shifts that I've seen. I did a training very recently where there was high consciousness in the room around racial equity. And a man who has done a lot of diversity work, and African-American, done a lot of diversity work, and clearly very, very immersed in that work and very knowledgeable about approaches. And as we went through the three-day training, he had these, it was just amazing to watch how some things that had been troubling him in the diversity work shifted and things fell into place in a way that I think is going to be transformative for him. For example, we were talking about the importance of stories, that storytelling is a source of wisdom in the circle process. It's not about advice. It's not about sort of our usual intellectual rigor. Not that you can't bring that. You can bring that. But ultimately, the knowledge in circle comes primarily out of stories, out of the understandings from our own lived experience. And we were talking about storytelling as an important component of the circle process. And he raised the question that he was really concerned about storytelling. And I realized that it was kind of challenging the idea of the storytelling and what would frame that was put in. And I realized that in his experience in a lot of diversity work, the storytelling is sometimes a bludgeon, right? The story is used to beat up, in this case, white people. And the story is very, very important, but the question is how you tell that story and how you are holding yourself in relationship to the person that you're offering that story to or pushing that story on, depending on how you... And that in circle, so I said, oh, yes, absolutely, it's not a free-for-all where everybody just puts their story out in a way that might be inducing huge shame and paralysis in the listener. That what you do in circle is you first establish a value-based container. And so when you create this value-based container, then you want the truth to be told. And that truth might be extremely painful around those stories of harm. But they're going to be told in that value-based container in a way that's not about shame and blame, but is about a deep understanding and sitting with the truth before we try to figure out how we go forward. And so there were pieces like that where he's been doing diversity work and feeling like we're not getting where we want to be, all of it really deeply well-intended and people working very, very hard at it. But I use the term called, that I learned from Brenda Morrison, ontological security, which she's defined as knowing who you are and where you belong. And so the conversation about storytelling in that term, that ontological security concept for him, gave him exactly what he needed to be doing the diversity work that he wants to do without it escalating shame and therefore distance, right? Because out of shame comes distance. So it was a thrill to me to watch this stuff that I've been working with become pieces that helped him put together some things that weren't quite fitting for him. He wasn't really satisfied with the way a lot of the diversity work is happening and the tools that he had. And it was like this was the missing piece. And it could just watch all of that click. And interestingly enough, we had somebody in the same training who was saying, I can see where this is really good for people to for people to share their feelings and to talk about the things like kind of on the spiritual side, but it wouldn't be a good way to make decisions, right? Because decisions have to be made in this logical, linear way. Mm-hmm. And this the other guy who works in diversity was the one making the case to the person who couldn't see how you'd make decisions in this way that, oh, yeah, because it's just that we've got this idea that the only way decisions can be made is linear. But that, in fact, is not the reality, that when you sit in this space, mm-hmm. you actually increase the capacity to make decisions. So I'm watching people take the ideas that are surfacing in the space we have together and begin to fit them into their own work and their own lives and break out of some things that felt like straitjackets to them. That's really what I saw with this guy. We gave him a way to break out of a straitjacket in terms of certain aspects of his work that didn't feel good.
Thank you. And so, Kay, what you were just describing reminds me of a process that you probably know quite a bit more than I do about, given your extensive work with Indigenous peoples and wisdom. And that's the process of the Haudenosaunee, I believe, that nonlinear decision-making that you were just describing, how that was the basis, I believe, for everything that that they knew to be true, was that they needed to go into that nonlinear space in order to be able to move forward in making important decisions, and even went to the extent of inviting their so-called enemies into that process with them. And I guess that segues into part of our theme today, which is creating those safe spaces and what it means, and of course learning and growing into what not knowing is. And wonder if you might share your own understanding and meaning of not knowing and how this might support a safe space. And if you'd like to also talk about what a safe space means to you.
So this idea of the importance of being able to not know has really been intensifying for me in the last couple of years. This is not something that I saw originally around what was happening. I think I was there maybe intuitively in some way, but really what I see happen, and it's because of me watching it over and over and over again, that I didn't understand it ahead of time, that the collective wisdom, in order for collective wisdom to emerge, you need to enter not knowing the answer. Because as soon as any one of us thinks we know the answer, we will try to drive the process in the direction of the answer with the best of intentions, absolutely the best of intentions. Because if we have the answer, we think, oh, this is what needs to happen. This will be good. So we exist in a culture where our status, our sense of worth, our deep sense of worthiness to be is tied to knowing. Right? We've been taught since we were born that to know is good, and that to know more is better, and to know is to be valued, to be worthy, to be paid well, to have power. We have so much in identity. Identity in this culture is very tied to knowing, to having answers. And that these processes, especially circle, ask us to not know. And it's so, so deeply countercultural. The wonderful thing is that it's a huge relief. If we can get there, it's like freedom. It's amazing freedom to not have to know. Mm-hmm. But that it's we have to release so much social conditioning to begin to open up, because then if we can sit in the space of not knowing, and the words that help me think about that are curiosity and wonder. And Howard Zaire quotes somebody, I don't know who it is, who defines wonder as not knowing experienced as pleasure.
Mm.
And I think these ideas of curiosity and wonder, that's what we're aiming for. But I think it's important to understand, because those are positive frames, to understand that we're asking for that at a level that's way beyond what has been culturally acceptable in the past. And that because that opens the space. That opens the space for that which cannot be predicted to emerge out of the collective. And I have no idea how this happens. I mean, I do not understand at all how it happens. I've just seen it happen so much that I have a lot of confidence in human collective wisdom, where the space is safe enough for people to be really speaking their deeper truth. So that depends upon this, that the collective wisdom, to be able to access collective wisdom, depends very heavily on being able to create safe space, safe enough for people to not know and not feel stupid, right? That's the problem we have, is to not know has been equated to being stupid, and we have to undo that hook. So there are very specific things that are part of the circle process that contribute to creating that kind of safe space. And when it gets safer, as a facilitator, you're safer too, and you can release control and let the group take responsibility for itself and allow it to work through some really uncomfortable things. But right from the very beginning of the circle, so the very first thing that you do beyond welcoming people is an opening ceremony. And that's very deliberate, like your minute of centering when you start your call, is that it makes a difference to slow people down, have them pay attention to being present, to orienting toward that best self in them. So beginning with an opening ceremony is a very important part of safe space. And then, I think the very structure of circle, so I like to say geometry matters. Geometry makes a difference. That the geometry of the circle is for human beings what the V is to geese who are flying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That the V, that particular alignment helps them to fly farther and faster, and the circle is the equivalent geometry for human beings. I think for a number of reasons. One is the sense of connection and common focus. Another is the equality, right? There's just no head to a circle. The equality is really implicit in the process. The other thing that's very powerful that I became aware of, didn't think about initially, but there's a kind of accountability in a circle that you don't have in other ways of people arranging themselves together. Because you have no tables, everybody can see everyone else and can see their body language as well as hear their voices. It's much clearer if people are texting, if people are having side conversations. There's a really very different kind of accountability in a circle, but at the same time support, this tremendous sense of support, because you're held in this very circles, geometrically the strongest form in terms of forces on the perimeter. So that helps to create the safety as well, if you're feeling like you belong, right? It could feel like a trap if it's not safe in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
then within the process, before we ever talk about any difficult issue, we spend time talking about what are the values we want to bring. And basically, it's a way of helping people remember who they want to be in their best self before they try to do any work together. And that's enormous in helping to begin to increase the safety in a group of people. And again, before getting into any difficult issues that you might want to discuss in circle, we spend time in sharing stories from our lives that help us to see ourselves in one another, right? That helps develop empathy. So even though we might think that person we're in conflict with has nothing in common with us, if we share stories about being an adolescent and feeling like we didn't fit in, that will completely change my sense of that other person and can no longer other them as much as I did initially. So there are a number of elements in the process that are continually trying to deepen the sense of safety so that people can just be who they are. And the circle has a lot of faith in people at their authentic self level. That if we can be authentic with one another, we can always figure out how to move forward constructively. Can't necessarily undo harm that has happened, but we can move toward healing, and we can move toward being more constructive with one another if we can be authentic in a space that's grounded in these values of who we want to be at when we're at our best. And there are a lot of people who never experience a safe space. There's no part of their life that has that kind of safety, so that if people experience it in circle, it's a real revelation that such a thing is possible. And begins to shift people's conception about what is possible when they experience that with others.
Now, Kay, on that stream that we've just been in of creating a safe space, I was reminded of some times I've spent with Leroy Little Bear and Glenn Aparicio Perry's Seed Institute Language of Spirit Dialogues that were extraordinary 3-day affairs where a circle process of sorts was created. And Leroy would always open the circle and talk about listening and the subtle and more finer points of listening and the Bohmian idea that we do have these tacit infrastructures, so to speak, especially in the Western world, perhaps, when we approach a process of dialogue. Now, if you could describe your own meaning of what deep listening really can be, and what are the properties and subtle aspects of deep listening, and how those support that safe space.
So the circle itself, deep listening is one of the major characteristics that find that the circle process supports and helps people who, I've had people who, the talking piece is a really big part of that. The talking piece being used to regulate the dialogue so that only the talking piece going in order around the circle and only the person holding the talking piece speaks, right? That basic characteristic of this process that I use, that engenders a deeper listening without people thinking about it or talking about it. I find I actually don't spend a lot of time talking about that when I start a circle. I find that it pretty much happens organically, that when people, once they get the hang of it, you know, and they get accustomed to the idea that they don't interrupt it, then they realize that they're not going to be speaking right away, so they don't need to be thinking about what they're going to say. So one of the big things that distracts us from deep listening is our concern about what are we going to say as soon as that person stops, right? And that can be something that we urgently want to put out there, or it could be just a sense of, oh dear, I'm going to be expected to respond. What am I going to say when that person stops? So when people get the sense of, oh, okay, I can't say anything now anyway, so I can let go of all those things that are popping through my head about what am I going to say, then I'm much more able to put my energy into the listening. So that's one piece of it. I also find that the physicality of the talking piece, people's eyes follow the talking piece. So people are looking at the person who's holding the talking piece, or looking at, in fact, sometimes just looking at it in their hands. And that creates, I think, a sort of energetic alignment that impacts the way we listen. So it's like all these, yeah, lines of energy go from each person in the circle to the one who's holding the talking piece. And because you can't speak without it, that energy is listening energy. And because you know that when you get it, you'll get to say whatever you want to say, and you can take the time to put your words together when it comes to you, and you're less distracted by your own thoughts. It quiets. It was interesting when I began to see this, that the talking piece quiets people down internally, which allows them to listen more deeply to one another. But before that can happen, actually, the thing that precedes that in circle that really helps is the opening ceremony and the conversation about values. That's about presence. It's about letting go of the stuff that happened before you came into the circle, or the stuff that you have to do after you leave the circle. And so some of the technique of circle is helping people to release the other stuff and helping people to focus just on whatever it is that the circle is about. All of those things contribute to the deep listening that happens in the circle. And I particularly think the sense of respect that you create in the circle, so that when people feel deeply heard, they're more willing to deeply listen. So it's another piece of why there's a capacity for deep listening in circle, is because people feel deeply heard. And when you feel deeply heard, you're much more willing to open yourself to open, right? So deep listening is really, I think, this listening with your heart and your mind open. Not trying to, again, and it's that thing of not knowing, right? Not trying to figure out what was right or wrong about what people are saying, or what it is they're supposed to do next, or what the answer is. So, it's listening from this place of not knowing where it goes next, wonder and curiosity, open mind and open heart. And there's a lot in the structure of circle that helps us to do that. I listen better in a circle than I do outside a circle, but the amount of time I spend in circle has helped me listen better outside of circle. I'm sometimes unconscious of reminding myself to just wait until it's my turn.
Well, I would definitely feel remiss if I didn't bring to the surface the amazing work that you and Carolyn Boyce Watson have been doing as it concerns youth and our schools here in the United States and probably beyond. And of course, the books I mentioned earlier, Heart of Hope, and the most recent edition, Circle Forward. I guess it could be considered a part two. Is that true, Kay? That
it's the Circle Forward is more specifically focused on schools and covers a wider range. Really covers the pretty much the gamut of ways that you might use circle process in school context, including circles for staff and circles for with parents, and obviously circles with students in the classroom. So the Circle Forward is more focused on schools and more complete, broad range of circles.
Well, and I happen to know that these books are flying off of the shelves. And I wondered what your sense of this is, in that how might it be telling us something about the collective desire to change how we conduct our systems, and what are you seeing?
In the last 18 months, we have seen an amazing shift in schools. Suddenly, zero tolerance became embarrassing, whereas for two decades it had been waved like a flag of pride, everybody claiming that they did zero tolerance. And suddenly, and I should say, it's not sudden in the sense that it took people a long time to, it was the school-to-prison pipeline movement, Dignity in Schools campaign, a lot of organizing by young people in various places, and also the work like of Michelle Alexander around racial disparities, that crescendoed to a point that it became embarrassing to all the major cities, the data around disparities in discipline, and this terminology, school-to-prison pipeline, was so visceral. That movement finally gained really significant traction. But what was amazing to me is how quickly then it shifted from people, the schools using suspension with no sense of responsibility or accountability around that, to all the major big cities suddenly telling the schools in their systems that they had to reduce suspensions, and in some cases telling them they couldn't use suspension anymore. The change happened when it finally came, happened very rapidly. So we were very fortunate. We had the book almost done. Well, we had it far enough along that when we saw this happen, I knew that the timing was right and we had to get it out as quickly as we could. The problem here is that there's now a widely expressed desire to reduce suspensions, and there's very little skill in our schools about what do you do instead. You can't ignore behavior that's causing harm to other students or to the classroom as a whole, but kicking kids out is not the solution. And so we sit in a place where there's a great deal of talk about restorative practices in schools and a great deal of interest, and a lot of places where people really have no idea what that actually means. So we're hoping that the book will help fill that gap for the people who really want to do the right thing and don't really know. How do we do this differently? Because people used to know more, because they didn't always kick kids out at that rate. But for two decades, they just used suspension as their way of trying to manage behavior in schools, and they lost some of the other skills that you need to be using. So it's a long road back, rebuilding those skills. But the work coming out of the restorative justice movement is essential, I think, to us changing the nature of how we manage collective groups in a building we call a school.
Thank you. Well, I think we have time for one more question before we go into our overall circle queue of questions. So for those of you who are with us and would like to ask a question, Preeta mentioned earlier there's a couple ways you can do that. And I believe one of those is ask@servicespace.org. You can email your questions for Kay. And also, if you're on the live stream, I believe you can text that. So, and Preeta will remind us in just a moment about that as well. Kay, I noticed that, that going back into Heart of Hope, you offer different applications of circles. And I was really struck by the masking grief circle and the resiliency circle. And of course, you have quite a few others. Could you talk about, just briefly, maybe one of those processes and what kind of application and meaning that might have and what you're seeing around that?
So the resilience helps us to shift from our constant deficit analysis into a more strengths-based approach. And so it's a very, very critical part of me moving forward. In our social sciences, our social work in this culture, we're very problem-focused, and there's a constant analysis of problems. And what a lot of people now believe is that that's actually energy draining, and what you want to be doing is not constantly talking about the problem, but actually talking about where you want to be and how do you get there from wherever you are. Acknowledgement of where you are. We're not talking about putting on rose-colored glasses. We need deep honesty about where we are. But then we don't spend a lot of time in analysis of that. The idea is, where do you want to go? And resilience, recognizing strengths, recognizing the good things that can come out of bad experiences is one of the most important aspects of shifting from deficit analysis into strengths-based work. And everybody who is alive has resilience. And that circle emerged around working with young people who have struggled with lots of different challenges, often some that are very personal, for instance, about their own families, and some that are much more systemic, things like racism. And that both of they suffer from trauma on both of those levels. But that we don't need to be defined by our trauma. We can look for what is that has allowed us to survive this long and be who we are, because even the people who are messing up a lot are not messing up all the time. There's nobody messing up all the time. And so you look at the places where we're not messing up. So in a circle like that, you ask people to talk about the you know, how, times in their lives when they made lemonade out of lemons, the times when something was really difficult and it made them stronger in some way. And it helps people, and this is where you start accessing your own wisdom from your lived experience, right? When people start looking at their own stories, where they've been strong in the face of difficulty, where they've survived something that you think, oh, how does anybody even get up every day in this context? That's where the wisdom lies. It lies in our own lived experience, particularly around our strengths and what gets us through.
Beautiful. Okay, do you have anything else you would like to add to our conversation thus far before we move into our question and answer conversation?
No, I'm interested in hearing the other voices.
Okay, great. Well, it's just been wonderful and an honor to be with you here, and I'm going to go ahead and hand over the mic to Preeta, and we'll get started with some questions.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Kay, for some amazingly insightful conversation.
We have a few callers already in queue, but I'm going to use the host prerogative and ask you one question before we jump in the queue, Kay. And I'm wondering, you know, all this talk of circle practice, and I think anyone who's participated in it knows how incredibly powerful and healing it can be for groups of people coming together. I wonder if you have thoughts, and this came up actually in some of the pre-call questions we got. How do you get in a difficult situation, a community to come together to sit in practice, and what kind of preparatory work do you do for the circle?
Well, it's very contextual, but I can say a few things about that. So one of the ways that you can sometimes engage communities, because it's not familiar to people, they may be a little wary, and it's sometimes a little hard to get started. So sometimes it's a crisis. There was a neighborhood in Minneapolis a number of years ago that experienced an armed robbery of a local business, and that was unusual in that neighborhood. Around that crisis, it was easy to get people to come to talk about safety in their neighborhood, and we put them in circles so that they could experience that and know what it is, and then think about, would this process be useful to us as a community? So sometimes it's around crisis that you get the opportunity. I mean, this is happening right now around police. This training that I did recently, one of the participants, an African-American woman, is a police officer, and within the training, she decided to design a circle for new recruits in the training of new police officers, have them sit in circle with community members so they would start building better relationships with community people. So right, and I'm now running into this a number of places where police are willing to come into circles now with community people because they are desperate to rebuild relationships and trust. It is often at a crisis that you will find a willingness for people to come into this space, which is otherwise pretty strange to them. Although we're always saying to people, if you can, for instance, in schools and in family, we say, try to start with positive circles first. So you do circles around birthdays or graduations so that people experience the process and get to understand what it means to sit in circle and how it works without it being high tension and or high conflict. So it's kind of at either end of the spectrum that we try to begin. I mean, sometimes your opportunity is around crisis, but if you can, you want to introduce circle to people around a positive celebratory kind of event and have them experience what it's like to sit in this space. Because what will happen in that space, even though you would think, well, if people are celebrating, it's already very positive and very nice, but you will get a much deeper conversation of honoring or of good wishes when you pass a talking piece than you will just in an ordinary interaction.
Great.
If you're using circle for a difficult circumstance, then you have to typically have to do some preparation of people beforehand, particularly if you're bringing together. See, one of the things to do, if you have two sides that you want to bring together to have dialogue in circle, actually the best approach is to do separate circles first, so that those two sides experience and get familiar with their process in a safe space with the people they trust, and also to get some clarity about what their actual concerns are with the other group, and then bring two groups together. So it is very important to think about what you have to do to help make it safe when they come together. So that's a part of building the safety. Because if you're coming into a completely strange process with somebody, some people that you really hate or deeply distrust, you got a double barrier to get over. And so you can separate that out by having people get familiar with circle in a group where they feel relatively safe. And then at least that barrier you don't have to overcome when you bring people together with someone that they don't trust or in conflict with.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to open it up now to the queue.
Hi, this is Arye in Half Moon Bay. Kay, it's great to hear you. Thank you for all the experience that you're sharing with us. As someone who's been involved in convening circles in some of my own communities, I really appreciate hearing from you and what you've been doing with some very difficult situations. And as a matter of fact, what I've been doing recently on my birthdays is doing a circle, asking people to share some stuff about wisdom. So I'm glad to hear that that you do that in the situations where
That's
you work.
I have a
question. My question is, would you be willing to share a story or two from your life about how you were led to doing this work that you do?
Okay. My journey to this work is completely accidental, in the sense of any conscious intention on my part, or almost completely accidental. It's a part of why I've learned to really trust not knowing, I think, is because it has worked so well for me. So I have a university education, but it has nothing to do, and I essentially have no formal training in any related field to the work that I do. I wanted to have my children young. I was married, wanted to have my children young, and so I stayed home raising my kids for 16 years. Got very involved in my community, served on a local school board for 9 years, did a lot of work on school reform in the 80s. And my kids are very close together in age. As they were entering high school, it dawned on me that they were going to leave 1, 2, 3, like really quickly, one after the other. And I thought, I have to build some other center in my life. And I'd been doing a lot of volunteer work in the community and really enjoying that and had learned so much. So I wanted work to be meaningful, and I couldn't get a job. I didn't have credentials for anything in particular. All the volunteer work I'd been doing didn't give me credit for anything, and so I had a really hard time finding a job. I applied to lots of different places. I mean, I was only looking for jobs that were meaningful to me in some way, so it was mostly nonprofits, and didn't even get interviews. And I finally got an opportunity to go to work for an agency in Minneapolis that did criminal justice work. I knew absolutely nothing about the criminal justice system. But the man who was the head of the agency was the husband of the superintendent in the school district where I was on the board. He knew I was intelligent, and he trusted me to work with his board members, which this particular job required. And I guess he assumed that I would learn what I needed to know about the justice system on the job, and that's what happened. I started there part-time. It pretty quickly grew to full-time. And that's where in 89, that's where I first ran into the pamphlets on restorative justice by Howard Zaire and Dan Van Ness, and that resonated to my own sense of the world. And actually, I have to step back. There was an article first that I read by Kay Harris, A Feminist Vision of Justice, and that really resonated for me. But I knew that you couldn't promote public policy with a feminist term in it in this country. There's just no way. Didn't know. Couldn't see where I could go with that. But then when I read the pamphlets by Howard Zaire and Dan Van Ness about restorative justice, I went, oh, my God, this is the same thing, and I know how to market this. Mm-hmm. And so I read everything I could get my hands on about restorative justice and began weaving those ideas into the work I was doing, because my job was about public policy, advocating good public policy in the justice system. So then in 94, the Department of Corrections in Minnesota created a full-time position. So I was interested in restorative justice, but I couldn't focus on that all the time at the nonprofit. I knew that I wanted to work on it full-time. So when the Department of Corrections in Minnesota created a full-time position in 94, I went there. And then it was in that job I learned about the sentencing circles in Canada. And of all the restorative processes, it was the sentencing circle process that most deeply captured my spirit. And partly because from the beginning in the restorative justice work, my thing was about community, not so much about individual reconciliation. It's about community and the larger questions of social justice. So my interest has always been much more at the community level than at the level of working out individual crimes or individual reconciliation. But none of this, anything I could ever have dreamed of. I could not have imagined the path that I've had.
Well, what a great example of the power and wisdom of showing up without knowing.
Yes, that's how it turns out. And I don't understand myself, how I ended up where I am. I don't understand often the impact that the work I'm doing seems to have. I don't think I work alone. I've become convinced that there is some kind of energy forces that find me as a useful channel. Yeah. From the beginning it was always like, could be gone tomorrow because this is not something in my control. but I just want to keep showing up and hoping that that I can continue to be useful to whatever those forces are that are operating through me.
Do you have an inner spiritual practice other than the circle practice for tuning into those forces?
I've been inspired over the years by a lot of Native practice, but I don't subscribe in a structured way. I've also been very inspired by Buddhist writings, particularly Western Buddhist writers. These understandings about interconnectedness and, sitting with the question rather than looking at the answer, I find those to be resonant both in ancient cultural understandings and in things like Buddhism. But for me, it's just kind of my own homegrown understanding because the concept of God doesn't work for me. So creator doesn't work for me. And my problem with that is hierarchy, that it feels like hierarchy. And so my sense is of profound interconnectedness, that's which is bigger than me, I am a part of, and we bow to each other. I don't bow to something above. And it's kind of just my own homegrown, because I had rejected the faith I grew up with. I was raised Catholic. I rejected that as a very young adult, decided that the purpose of life was to love and be loved, and that was sufficient to motivate the right kind of behavior. And that beyond that, I didn't know. And I was okay with that. I guess maybe I could sit with the not knowing earlier than I realized.
Right.
And then as I raised my children, I began to feel that spirituality, and I thought I was an atheist or an agnostic. I didn't know which because I didn't know what the difference was, and I didn't bother to look it up. Then as I was raising my children, I began to feel that spirituality was important, couldn't tell you what it is. And then when I got into this work, it was very clear to me that spirituality has meaning to me, but it doesn't fit into any particular structure or discipline.
Thank you, Kay.
Thank you so much, Kay. That's a great segue into one of our actual, one of the questions we got in from the live stream. And this comes from someone in Sebastopol, California, who says she's a restorative practices educator, trainer, and training designer. And in your discussion a little bit earlier on about the ceremonial opening ceremony and kind of how you discuss that, she mentioned that she's getting a little pushback that the ceremonial opening especially, but that the ceremonial qualities in general of this type of circle work can create barriers for participants of various religious and spiritual orientations. She said she's being asked to tone that down in order to not turn folks away. She said, I'm a believer myself, but want to meet people where they are, communication being the most important element. What are your thoughts? And I guess maybe to supplement that, I would just say, if you have examples of working with maybe, some conservative religious communities that might be turned off by some of the native ceremonial things, are there ways in which you can communicate with different communities about the practice?
Yes, so I was trained by First Nations people who always opened with the smudging, the burning of sage. But as soon as I began to practice, I knew that that was not something I could do in most places. I loved it myself. I like having someone do that, but it would not be appropriate most places that I would train. First of all, I could be seen as co-opting another culture. Or secondly, I could be seen as imposing another faith system on someone. So what I did was think about, what is it you're achieving with that ceremony? What is that ceremony about? It's about cleansing. It's about pause. It's about orienting toward the positive, taking a deep breath to let go, to release other unrelated tensions. And then began to think about, okay, so what other things can you do? So I think it's absolutely essential that you not throw up barriers to people with what you do as an opening ceremony, and I think it's absolutely essential that you do an opening ceremony. So you begin to look for, okay, what would work for this group of people? Sometimes it's a little bit of breathing. It could be silence. In training, I do a thing called group juggle that's playful, but definitely achieves all those things I talked about in terms of beginning to connect people and helping people to bring themselves to be fully present and be centered in the space, release other distractions, pause, right? The big part of circle is slow down. So few deep breaths. Readings, poetry, inspirational readings you can find. So if you're working with a conservative religious group, in fact, if you're working with a group that's all the same religion, you can just draw from their religion, because that will be the most meaningful to them in terms of achieving those things that you're trying to do with an opening ceremony. So the thing is that you really have to pay attention, because it's a question of safety. If you're doing something that's uncomfortable for people, you're actually making it less safe, and then that means you have to do more work in the circle to try to regain that sense of safety. So it's really about designing ceremony, opening and closing ceremonies. We have a lot of stuff at the back of both Heart of Hope and Circle Forward in terms of readings, a few activities. If it's an ongoing group, you can actually involve the group in designing their own opening and closing. You can use a different word than ceremony. You just talk about it as openings and closing. If it's the term ceremony that's turning people off, change the language, but it's really, really critical, I believe, to create this transition, this pause, that is beginning to help the group get their energy in alignment together before you move into whatever you're going to do.
Terrific. I'm going to go to the next person.
This is Michelle Ehlers calling in from San Jose, California. I'm very grateful for your work and fascinated by it. I have been exploring what I call transformational global leadership for a number of years, and looking at how we can create alignment at the global level of humanity, which is, I have no clue, but just exploring it. So I have some familiarity with the circle practice and the creating a group consciousness. I'm wondering what thoughts you have about how we can take that. And I know, I'm very interested, you said that you're focusing on the community social justice, not just the individual. Do you have any thoughts about how to take it to communities of communities and maybe apply this at the global level as we're trying to deal with global issues such as climate change, which requires participation of very diverse communities from all over the world with very different backgrounds and thought processes, and yet we need to be able to do that to deal with some of our global issues.
Exactly. I don't know how to take it to, I talk about this as taking it to scale, because I also talk about CIRCLE as much more fundamentally democratic, because in the process I use, decisions are made by consensus, which means that everybody has to be able to say, I can live with it. And it's, I see it as much more fundamentally democratic than majority rule, and that it would be wonderful if we could begin to expand our understanding of democracy and make more decisions like this, because no one can be run over in a consensus decision-making process. It's not a question of numbers. So so I think often about, okay, how do you take it to scale? So I can see how you do that in a group of, you know, 25 people making a decision together. It gets more difficult when you're talking about 1,000 people in some kind of, you know, city planning process. Although we are exploring and experimenting with that in some places. How do you take this process into public decision making around municipal planning? I don't know. I'm pretty sure that if we keep practicing at the local level, we will figure it out. So one piece for me is that we start practicing this, making decisions in our families, making decisions in our organizations, workplaces, making decisions in lots of different places, that we start practicing sitting in CIRCLE as a way of making sure all voices are included and heard and all the stories are understood at some level in order to understand where people are coming from. When we think about that, and if you do that, if, I think that as we do that, we will figure out how to take it to scale in a more structured way. But in the meantime, the other thing that we're doing, every time you sit in CIRCLE, you are practicing all the social-emotional literacy skills. You're practicing listening. You're practicing paying attention to what's going on inside you. You're practicing awareness of others' emotions because emotions are welcome. We're practicing all these things about listening, not jumping to conclusions, not making judgments. And in the end, the point is not to get good at doing those in CIRCLE for the sake of CIRCLE. The point is to develop those skills so that we can take them out into every other arena of our lives, so that we could listen to the news and try to be with a more open heart and more open mind about
sure.
the things that annoyed us
right.
so much. So I think the more we have people sitting in CIRCLE, the more we can get people to think in those ways and begin to struggle with those larger global questions. Because all of those global questions are also very personal. Especially, when, I mean, you talk about climate change stuff.
Yep.
Man,
yep.
None of us escapes that, even
yep.
short, you know, in the short run. You know, economic issues, some people can feel insulated. But climate issues, there's no insulation for anybody. So I think it's practice, you know, practice and practice and practice. And introducing it any place that you have a potential platform. And holding the other side of all of this for me that's really challenging is to hold compassion for those who are coming from a different place and a place I see is causing a lot of harm.
Mm-hmm.
To be willing to assume that they have the same best self as all these other people I sit in CIRCLE with. And that they have a story that would explain, you know, because I got introduced to this process in the justice system, we were sitting in CIRCLE with people who were seen to have caused harm, sometimes great harm. And there's always a story that helps you understand how it came to be. Does not justify that doing it, but helps you understand how it came to be. And I think that that's the same thing we need to begin to apply at the political level with the people. For instance, the people who are very attached to the Confederate flag. Can we understand the story of how they came to be attached to that flag? And it's not necessarily the same thing we imputed to the, mm-hmm. you know, waving that flag around. How do we take these seven core assumptions in our own thinking and begin to project something different than we have generally, certainly for myself in the past, for people who politically disagree with me, and trying to learn to look for the story even where I deeply disagree with the conclusion that people have come to out of their story.
You're right.
It's that kind of sort of wrestling with our own demons that I think is going to be necessary, and it's very personal, and at the same time we need to be talking out loud about it, because when we talk out loud about it, we can take it to another level. We can encourage others who maybe were thinking the same thing but didn't see a way to bring it forward, that we start to bring those energies together.
It's so wonderful.
I can see that this would be really useful to apply at a community of communities level. If you would be interested in furthering the conversation about how to take it global, I'd love to be in communication with you, how to apply it at the global level.
Yeah. My contact information is in the back of not the last two books, but if anybody has the little book of Circle Process, my contact information is in the back. And mm-hmm. I'm always happy to be connected.
Great. Thank you so much. Kay, I love the way you responded. It's very much true to, it turns out, service-based values as well, which is, you know, how to shift the world is to first start with the small shifts within yourself.
And I want to say around that I, the kind of stuff that came for me through restorative justice and circle process, I see those same ideas in lots of different movements. And it's a part of what really excites me. So these ideas are not unique to Circle. They're very ancient understandings, many of them. And they're in lots of different impulses, and some of them very organized impulses that are happening around the globe. It is, for me, one of the signs that the shift is coming, is that these wonderful ideas are surfacing independently in lots of different places at the same time.
How wonderful. Okay, we're going to go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Janelle from New York, and it's not so much of a question as it is a comment for Kay. I actually came to the same path of not knowing, and then my path crossed with yours. And we did a lot of foundational work in New York State that 16 years ago was looked at with, you know, the side eye, like what is going on here. So I just wanted to say thanks, Kay, for helping us to lay a really amazing foundation for the future of juvenile and criminal justice in New York State and where it's headed, or where I believe it's headed. And a lot of that was done with your influence. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's so wonderful to hear your voice.
Yours too.
Yeah, and as someone who's read several of Kay's books and participated in one of her trainings, I would really encourage all of you to take a look at her rich and varied body of work, not only with respect to restorative justice, but also schools, communities, and then the little book of Circle Practice, which Kay mentioned, is very much kind of the basic primer on how to hold circle, I think. And it's just, and then all of the other publications she's done give you really specific suggestions about different aspects of it. I just found it to be incredibly useful and helpful. So as we wrap up, Kay, I wonder, one question we typically ask our guests is, how can we, as the larger space service community, support your work?
You've caught me off guard with that one. I feel so lucky about my work, have not, you see, as it happened unplanned, I don't have any plan. And so that's a hard question to answer. What I mean, for me, it's to do what you can do where you are with these core ideas, which are not mine. They emerge from, I think they emerge from our genes, actually. The really core ideas we're talking about here, I think, are in all of us. So part of my understanding of circles, we all have this wisdom. I have nothing new to teach anybody. But what we lack are the spaces where we can be in touch with our own wisdom and the collective wisdom. So I guess the best thing would be to just, wherever you can, to cultivate spaces where you can be in touch with your own wisdom and support the collective wisdom.
That's so fantastic. I love so everything you've said, especially starting with the notion that we have everything we have within us as we're born, and it's just a matter of tapping into it. As I think you said at the start, the true self in everyone is good, wise, powerful.
Powerful, yeah. And once we know that, we can relax and we don't need to control others, and lots of good things flow from that.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again. Really, really, really rich conversation. As always, I'm always so struck by your wisdom and your incredible work that you've done in so many communities. So if we could just close with a moment of silence.
Thank you.
So now we're going to express our gratitude for you, Kay. We will do a collective shout out of our gratitude for you. So I'm going to unmute the lines and hopefully everyone can express themselves.
Thanks, Kay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great way to spend a Saturday.
The best way.
Thank you. Have a great
You're
day,
welcome.
Everyone.